Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, indeed, it's time for another podcast, and today we're going to be talking about the sport of kabaddi, and we're also going to be catching up with a young man who's just taken on the task of being the coach of the Iran, yes, Iran Rugby Sevens team. It's a slightly different show because I, Ashley Morrison, am coming to you from India.
And I, John Lee, are coming to you from Perth.
So we welcome you to Not the Footy Show. Well, John, there's been a fair bit happening in the world of sport, but as I said, I'm up in India because it's the Kabaddi World Cup. Now, have you ever heard of kabaddi?
Well, luckily enough, I've been around you a little while, so I have heard of kabaddi. I don't know much about it, but I do believe there's an Australian team there as well.
There is indeed. Now, I must admit, I've had a crash course the last 9 days. We've been locked in a room learning the rules, the nuances, and learning all about the teams. And it's a sport that I'd seen on TV when I'd been up here commentating the hockey. And I was kind of like, yeah, okay, that's a little bit interesting. I got the idea of it. But since I've sort of got into it now, I've got to say, I think it's an absolutely brilliant sport.
So for us who don't have a clue at all, how would you describe it?
Well, it's sort of like British Bulldogs, a bit of wrestling, but it is incredibly tactical. So the court is not very big. So it's only 13 meters in length, 10 meters wide. And you have a maximum of 7 players on the court at any time. And defense is a really big part of the game. So you then have one raider comes forward, and his job is to go into the other team's half, touch either with a kick or a hand touch, and then he has to get back and get his touch across the other side of the midline in the center of the court. Now, if he does that, if he touches 2 defenders, he gets 2 points. If he touches 1, he gets 1 point. If the defenders prevent him from getting back into his own half of the court, then they get the point. When there are 7 or 6 defenders, there's 2 lines on the court. The first is the balk line. So before he can get a point, he has to put his foot over that line to make the raid legitimate. And then the second line is a bonus point line. So when there's 6 or 7 defenders on the court, if he gets his foot over the bonus line, which is really close to the end line, and then manages to get back, he gets a bonus point. But it's not quite as easy as just putting his foot over there. So to put his foot over the line for the bonus point, he must put his grounded foot over the line, but the other foot must be in the air. So you can imagine, therefore, all the balance is on the foot that is forward, which makes it easier for the defenders to grab him.
So basically, let me see if I've got this right. You've got to jump into the other team's half, touch a bloke or woman,
yeah,
and then get back before they pummel you.
Pretty much, yeah. And then on the side of the court, there is what they call the lobby. So once you've made a touch, you can use that extra, it's about sort of a meter wide area to make your escape to halfway. Now, if they push you out, your whole body can be in the air as long as you touching your side of the court. But if you're sort of on the ground and they're pushing you out of place, some part of you must be in the lobby while you touch across the line.
So it is formalized version of British Bulldog, essentially.
Essentially, yeah, it is. And I mean, then they have those various things like a super tackle, which is when there's one raider and only 3 defenders. And if they manage to prevent him, then they get a bonus point. But the key thing is, obviously, if they prevent him, when you get a tackle, you get a player back on the court. So if you've lost a player, every time you get a point, except for when you get a bonus point, you redeem one of those players to come back out onto the court.
Now, when you use the word tackle, I take it you're not using the word in the same sense as, say, rugby union making a tackle. It's more like scragging in any which way possible you can.
Oh, no. It is a tackle, because if they get any part of them over the line and you're touching that tackle, you've made the attempt to tackle, you're out, because if he gets back, that's classed as a touch. So they are. The main thing is when they go for the bonus point line, this is what they call an ankle hold. So the guys are really quick, grab your ankle, and then they twist your legs, lift it up and twist it so you can't go anywhere. And then there's another tackle which is called a dash, which they literally just barge you off the court as you're making your way to the midline. And then there are what they call a thigh hold. So it's like, and a double thigh hold is just like a basically a rugby tackle where the defender just wraps himself around your legs and prevents you going anywhere. And then there is a typical sort of like block tackle where the guy just makes himself really big and just bundles you backwards as you're making your way to the midline.
Now, by the way you're describing this game, people may think it's just huge blokes, but you were saying before we went to air, there's a weight restriction. They're not all of them ginormous fellas.
Now, there is a weight restriction of 85 kilograms, and had the weigh-in yesterday, and only one player actually failed that. The thing that's incredible is the way they defend it is so tactical, and it is so the communication between people, and you have to have that sort of 180, 360 degree peripheral vision. And just to make it that little bit more complicated, John, every raid is 30 seconds long, and while you're doing the raid, you must utter the word kabaddi. So you've got to keep saying kabaddi, kabaddi, kabaddi. So that's called the cant. And if you stop canting, then you're out and you lose a point and the opposition get one.
I love the way you have to chant. That's fantastic. That's so Indian.
It is indeed. Now, I know this is not the footy show, but the Australian team, there are three former AFL players participating for Australia. And they believe that the skills from that game are going to really help them. But we've got Campbell Brown, who, of course, is a good West Australian.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We also have Adam Schneider and Stephen Milne, who both obviously don the colours of St Kilda.
I mean, you're talking about guys that are pretty decorated there. Two premiership players. Milne kicked a lot of goals in his career. He was a very much loved player by St Kilda. It's quite interesting that the players of that profile would be trying out at kabaddi.
Well, it was really interesting. I mean, I had a long chat with Campbell Brown, in fact, with all of them, actually, but Campbell Brown was the one who got the phone call. He was knew the guy that was actually involved with coaching the team, and so he went ringing around some of his mates and said, hey, look, do you want to have a go at this? So the Aussies have been training, I think, extensively. They've been training for 5 hours, 5 days a week, for 3 hours every evening. And Essendon have been coaching them and lending them all their facilities, strength and conditioning coaches, absolutely everything. And I think one of their physios has actually come up with the team. And a couple of the guys, and I can't remember where they're from in Melbourne off the top of my head, but they've been driving for 2 hours every day to training and back. So that shows real commitment on their part. So it'll be very interesting how they go. Typical Aussies, though, you know, they're meant to have their names on the back of the shirt, but they've all gone for nicknames.
Yeah. Now that's going to cause some confusion.
It is. We've actually got the Americans arrived yesterday, and they had visa problems. So they actually only got in. Their very first bout is going to be against Iran, who are one of the favourites. Half the team arrived yesterday morning and the other half yesterday evening. So you really do worry for the Americans, because I'm not sure that they're going to be on the same time zone, let alone, you know, mentally in the right place to be playing one of the opening games.
I'm just surprised they found seven Americans under 85 kilograms.
Are these guys, again, to be fair, I watched them train yesterday, and some of them are former linebackers. Quite a few of them have got really good track and field records, that they were 400 meter runners, 800 meters or sprinters. They were very, very lean. There was not an ounce of fat on them, because they were training with their shirts off, which I have to say a lot of the Indian women were like, oh, we're watching with great interest. But it'll be, I think it'll be very interesting to see how they go because, you know, you do have some of the teams have got sort of a rugby background. The Americans have got a sort of basketball, sprint and, you know, gridiron background. We've got the Australian team with obviously an Aussie rules background. And it's going to be, I think, very interesting to see how they all go about and whether their tactics or the skill set that they have, how they cope with the game as a whole, you know, up here.
Now, in this era of gender equality, I've got to ask, do women play kabaddi?
They do indeed, yeah. They just had the Women Beach Kabaddi World Cup was held when I got in India, and India actually took out the title there. So the Beach Kabaddi, I think it's only five-a-side. It's not quite as big as the seven-a-side. And there's also another, the traditional form of the game is circle kabaddi, where they do it in a circle. But that has kind of given way now to the mat so that they can take it indoors, really market the game and make it really exciting. And the venue here, it was, if you'd have seen it a week ago, it was just an empty warehouse. And it is just one of the most amazing sights now last night when we were there. It is just incredible what they've achieved. And this stadium as well, John, I mean, we talk about, you know, the stadium that's being built out at Burswood. But this stadium, when we got here, it was just like a massive warehouse. But then when we went in and we went up two stories, on the roof is a football stadium, a soccer stadium. And they were laying the grass and they were putting in the concrete for the tiered seating. When we hadn't sort of gone into the venue that way again until last night. And suddenly, you know, the plastic seats are in. The pitch is looking amazing, and it's just incredible what they've achieved within a week. There's the health and safety side of things is a little bit different. There's not many hard hats, certainly no steel toe cap boots, I have to say. And there were plenty of rats running around when we got there the first day.
Is kabaddi something you can see spreading, or is it going to remain a little niche Indian thing, do you think?
Well, this is what they're hoping with the World Cup, that this will be the chance for it to really, really spread. It is actually the second most watched television sport in India. So the viewing figures for the IPL or cricket are around 600 million. Kabaddi's figures were 423 million. And when you think sort of hockey, which is regarded as their national sport, sits at around 170 million. So kabaddi's, you know, shot past that. And what they're desperately trying to do with this World Cup, and that's why they've called in myself and a commentator from New Zealand called Stephen McIver, is they want to sort of make it more acceptable to the Western world with Western voices commentating it in the hope that it will take on. And they it's already in the Asian Games, and they're hoping that with time they can get it into the Olympic Games.
Can we view it at all? Is it on the internet, do you know?
You can get it. It's on Star. Have got a program, Hotstar. If you go to the Star Sports sort of website or whatever, or app, you should be able to get it there. It does say that it's going to be aired in Australia, but I've spoken to a few people who've looked on Fox Sports and they can't see it on the schedule. Whether Fox have got it and are going to just drop it in, we'll have to wait and see. But I would think SBS certainly have been writing articles about the Australian team, so they may well be picking up some highlights, and so you may hear that. I am actually commentating the Australia-Iran game first up, so tomorrow night, so that should be interesting.
Oh, well, good luck. Good luck to the boys too. I mean, it'd be a great experience, I'm sure.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
It sort of segues nicely, John, because mentioning Iran there, who are one of the teams that are tipped to knock India off their perch, I caught up with a gentleman in London who actually is got the role of coaching the Iran Rugby Sevens team. Now, Iran, as you and I know, they're not really known for their rugby. And I was thinking it must be pretty hard to be a coach based in London when your team's all in Iran. So that was why I wanted to catch up with Liam Dunseith. Liam Dunseith, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be on the show.
Well, Well, Liam, really interested in the fact that you have just taken on the role of rugby sevens coach for Iran. But before we talk about that, I wondered if you could give us a little bit of an insight into your rugby background.
Yep, was introduced to the game when I was 11. The school I went to was heavily into rugby in Essex, just outside London, and was massively part of the curriculum. And then when I left school, went to university in Manchester, ended up being captain by default, probably because of the number of years I'd been studying there. And then when I moved back to London, played for a couple of sort of semi-pro but best rugby teams in London, Richmond, Roslyn Park. I really enjoyed my rugby developing throughout my 20s. Played a lot of sevens in the States. I lived in the States for 2 years in Daytona Beach, Florida, in Long Island. So keeping up with those guys was quite tough. A lot of the players on my side were running sub-11, second hundreds. So gives you an idea of how quick they are. And I started coaching about 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago in a local primary school. They had a rugby club after school. I wanted to do some volunteering. And then a friend of mine, he had been begging me for about 2 years. He'd started playing rugby and was a winger. He was quite fast. And he wanted me to come down to his local club in southeast London, give him a few tips. So I went down there, helped him out. Eventually started helping the back three. And then before you know it, I'm taking the warm-up, the speed, agility, quickness, the defensive drills, the team run, all the skills. A lot of responsibility and really enjoyed it. So eventually decided that when I'd seen the Iranian rugby team was struggling, I thought maybe I'd take a little leap from amateur rugby to amateur international rugby.
And how did the job come about? I mean, was it advertised or did you approach them and say, hey, look, I'd really like to help you guys? And if so, why Iran?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly wasn't any job posting advertised. It was quite a bizarre one. I'd seen a documentary online about Iran's rugby and the things that Wayne Masters, fantastic coach from New Zealand, was doing in the region and for Iran. And it appealed to me. My best friend is Iranian. He's lived in London almost 15 years. And Hadi is a very different guy to a lot of my English friends or other friends. So I thought it'd be nice because our friendship had blossomed and flourished so much, something to go there on a holiday to Iran, perhaps to see his culture. And if I could help their rugby in some way, maybe I could combine the two. So I wrote to the president of the Rugby Federation, Dr. Hassan Agabek. And he replied, and he had a head coach at the time. So I was the assistant coach and travelled over to Beirut in Lebanon for the West Asia Rugby Championship, where Iran played Lebanon and Jordan last year. Was invited to a training camp to assist the 15s programme in Tehran last June. And then this year I was invited to be... Originally, it was technical advisor, and then I was bumped up to head coach of the Sevens program.
Right. And I mean, I'm presuming that they don't play in that many tournaments at the moment.
So internally, they do. They love their beach rugby and they love their Sevens. A lot of clubs are based in between Tehran and Shiraz. So in terms of international rugby, Asia Rugby Federation will put on an event once a year for 15s in the region and once a year for sevens. So they only really generally play in a big tournament possibly once or twice a year. The rest is internally on a sort of ad hoc basis when they can get a team together. There's no structured league, unfortunately, but they are so passionate and completely mad about rugby. I mean, if you're friends with any of these players on Instagram, because Facebook and Twitter's blocked, you will see they're constantly posting rugby pictures and rugby videos. It's a way of life for them, really.
Well, that's actually sort of the first point, isn't it? If people have got the passion, then usually they're willing to learn. I mean, what is the standard like? I mean, is it a good standard?
the guys are passionate, and you know, I'm happy to coach people that want to learn and develop their own skill set for themselves and the team. Certainly, the physicality is a massive aspect of Iranian rugby. There's no doubt about it, especially in the 15s, because of their influence from wrestling and weightlifting. They're very strong, powerful guys. Obviously, sevens, when you transfer to sevens, it's slightly different. It's for me, as a coach, I like to have a team that is full of speed and can keep possession of the ball. So then your skill, different skill sets start coming in. But obviously, your set-piece contest is extremely important in sevens, your scrums and your line-outs. And Iran generally does dominate in those areas in their sevens program. It's other sort of areas of the game that we might not be as deep in that we need to develop, really.
You mentioned playing in America, and we've seen that America is usually sort of bringing their team is very much about finding the fastest guys and teaching them to catch and then learn the basics of seven, or that's how it appears. I mean, do you have some pacey players in Iran, or are they more, as you say, the structural physical guys?
Yeah, we have a bit of both, really. I think America will be very disappointed from their Olympic their Olympic dream that was shattered. I mean, they certainly know that they underperformed, but that's another story. And I'm sad for them because I expected USA to win a medal. And they've certainly developed their game fantastically over there. Yes, we do have some speedsters, and they are obviously weapons for us in the team, and we try and utilise them as much as possible. But we like to have plan B and C as well. And at the end of the day, the lads are trying to develop their skills for heads-up rugby. So it's not just about getting the ball to our speedsters. It's about playing what's in front of you. And they're learning that, taking baby steps.
How many sessions are you having with them? Because you're still based in the UK, and obviously I presume most of the players, in fact all of them, are probably still playing in Iran.
Yep, correct. I'm based in London. So I fly over when I'm invited over for a training camp, usually at the Olympic Academy or at the RZD Stadium, which is their national stadium complex in Tehran, which covers football and lots of other sports. So, yeah, I have a very small time window to try and get out their potential, to teach them new individual skills, micro and macro skills. And it is intense. But that's how it is. You know, it's not a full-time role. I don't get paid for my work. I don't get paid for my expenses, but it's because I love it and I believe that the guys deserve an opportunity that keeps driving me back there. So that's why I do it.
What are your biggest challenges with them? I mean, is it, again, funding issues, or is it of having enough time with them to be able to make the impact you need to make them competitive?
Yeah, funding is always a challenge. You know, sometimes it's difficult, not just funding, but resources in general. Resources in terms of knowledge about nutrition, recovery. Of course, resources for accommodation and food, supplements. And obviously the facilities can sometimes be a struggle. But these are just things I believe that can be overcome. I think the main challenge for me, actually, because Iran has been cut off from the outside world, and I didn't want to touch on it too much, but it's, let's not shy away from the fact that the United Nations have cut off Iran. I think it's the main challenge for me is getting the players to believe that they generally can stand up and be counted in this day and age in society, in the region. It's getting them to believe in themselves that they are worthy enough to be decent semi-pro or pro rugby players. And that just because they've had some bad luck or misfortune in their lives with being cut off from the outside world doesn't mean to say that they shouldn't stand accountable. And I'm trying to change their mindset to get them to believe in themselves. And we're slowly, we're doing okay. Well, I look at the Hong Kong qualifier for the Olympics, and I compare it to the Asian Rugby Development in Al Ain in Dubai this spring, and we're making progress. You know, we're letting in less tries, we're making more tackles, we're completing more tackles, we're scoring more points, so the systems seem to be working.
What you touch on there, do you feel as well that it's going to help you make them realise that they can compete if they get invited to, say, more tournaments overseas and are given those opportunities? Because I would have thought, you know, say if they were able to come to Australia, if they get exposed to playing here, then they're going to suddenly realise that the world does believe in them and does want them to do well.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, any team that gets invited overseas wants to do their best, represent their country, be proud and just put everything they've got into it. So a tournament like that or a trip where they're playing overseas would be absolutely fantastic, you know. They only get the opportunity once a year, and it's only sort of in the region of the Middle East. So it is slightly different to Iran. But when you go to a completely different culture, I think it will open your eyes and it can change you as a human being completely.
Well, Liam, I hear you've actually set up a sort of funding, put your hand out for some funding for coaching clinics.
That's right. I mean, I decided it was time to get some external help. There doesn't seem to be too much help internally. And I decided to set up this coaching clinic for this December. And the campaign that I've used is through Just Giving. So if your listeners do want to donate, it's justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Iran Rugby Coaching. And what this coaching clinic is specifically for, the top 14 players in Iran that will be chosen from the federation. What it is just an extra top-up learning coaching clinic. I just feel that having a coaching clinic once a year is not enough. And if Iran wants to break into the top sides of Asia, they need some extra help. So it's a coaching clinic classroom and pitch-based. It's to reinforce the learning that we've already done back in the spring, but some extra top-up learning of new systems in attack and defence, but also working on our existing skill set and our strengths and weaknesses. So that'll be the pitch-based stuff. And then the classroom stuff is generally just to get players to get together and discuss amongst themselves what they think and where they think they can get better, what they feel that they need to do to beat other opposition throughout Asia. So there'll be bits of discussion, video analysis, and then I'm hoping to bring in specialist strength and conditioning guys to help out and touch on also nutrition and recovery and a little bit about anti-doping. So I'm trying to raise £7,000 for a five-day coaching clinic, which will be obviously very intense. We've only got 5 days and lots to get through, both out on the field and in the classroom. And the bulk of that money will be going straight on the players for their accommodation, for their food, their equipment and kit that I'm shipping out. And a little bit of the funding will go towards coaches like myself, the visas and the flights, getting over to Iran, etc.
And what was that address again if people do want to donate?
Yep, it's justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Iran Rugby Coaching. So even if you can't remember that and went on Google, look for justgiving.com or justgiving crowdfund and then Iran Rugby and hopefully it'll pop up for you.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's great. And I mean, we'll give that website a plug again and hopefully you can get the money together. And there might be some people in Australia who want to donate to that, because I'm sure there's quite a tie with Iran to Australia. It might surprise a few people, but there's been a bit of rivalry in football over the years, and I think there's a sort of nice little bit of respect for them as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, there was there's one player, I'll give another shout out to Fudge. He lives in Australia. He's an Aussie. Aussie-Iranian, and he's flown over a few times to represent Iran. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that there is a massive influence of Australian-Iranian players probably waiting out there that want to get involved, either through playing or coaching or donating. You know, everyone is welcome to help Iranian rugby, Iranians or non-Iranians.
Now, I did see when you first went to Iran, you were a little bit surprised when you met the players that traditionally, obviously, they give you a kiss on both cheeks. Have there been any other sort of cultural issues that you've sort of been a little bit taken by surprise with?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things, you just get on with it, right? It's part of their culture, and it's how they go around their daily life. And actually, it's quite sincere, so it just shows their affection for you, really, and what you're trying to do to help them. It becomes just a way of life, really. But in terms of other things, yeah, I mean, a few things here and there that took me by surprise that perhaps I shouldn't go into detail about, but just respect their culture. But once you start talking about language barrier and massive cultural differences that shock you, I think then you start forgetting about what you're actually there for, and that is the rugby coaching. And of course, a few things will come up here and there, but you just accept it, get on with it, and embrace it, really. And then, because you're there for the actual rugby coaching, and Eddie Jones is absolutely right. The coach is indebted to the player, and every time I go over there, I try and figure out ways that I can do things better and differently as a coach to help them to develop their skills, their knowledge, and just to make them a better team. And if you want to, you know, I don't want to name too many names. I'm not even a soccer or football fan, but Sir Alex Ferguson is absolutely right. When a coach becomes complacent, it's a disease. It's very hard to shake off. So if I charge someone X amount of money for a rugby coaching session, or if I do it for Iran for nothing, you're still going to get the same output from me. You're still going to get the same passionate. You're still going to get the same preparation, and you're still going to get the same enthusiasm for me to get those players to unleash their potential and become a better team.
Liam, finally, I mean, you've said the goal is the 2024 Olympic Games. That's 8 years away. Are you in there for the long haul? Are you going to be there for that full eight-year journey?
Well, I'm not being approached by anyone else. And I don't have any connections with anyone else as yet. So that may answer your question. It's a Pandora's box that's been opened up, a can of worms. So once I jump through one hoop, another hoop's there ready for me. And I'm not the kind of guy to shy away from those hoops. And in fact, I won't say who it was, but an international coach told me in the spring that I was wasting my time in Iran, and a very highly respectable international coach said I was wasting my time, and I completely disagreed with him. And that fuels you even more when people dismiss you, they don't understand you, they almost laugh it off. These guys deserve an opportunity, and it's not happening internally, so it has to come from outside.
No, I would have thought that would be the biggest spur you ever needed, to be honest.
Yeah, I like to prove people wrong, but, you know, you don't win games by egos, right? I haven't done anything for Iran yet. I haven't won anything. I'm aware of that. And coaches and teams are looked on as results. So we're having a little transition period in the last year and a half, 2 years. But hopefully, with the help of people like myself, with the Asian Rugby Federation, who are doing some great things, may I add, going into the schools, helping the schools in Iran get rugby into their curriculum, the Get In to Rugby program. Hopefully, you know, slowly but surely we can take baby steps, and 8 years isn't that far off. So we start targeting the 12, 14-year-olds. I think, you know, in 8 years, Iran's got a good shot of making the Olympics.
Well, Liam, it's been great catching up with you, and I hope to follow that journey for the next 8 years. And definitely want to stay in touch with you. But all the very best, and thanks very much for your time.
Ash, thanks for having me on the program. I really appreciate it.
Hi, I'm JC Jand from West Coast Fever, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Liam Dunseith, and I think it's an incredible story. And of course, if you want to donate to him and help put on those coaching courses for Iran, then you've got the URL to contact there, and I will put it in the post when it comes up on Not the Footy Show. But we hope that you enjoyed that. I think it's fantastic what he's trying to achieve. And I love it, John, when you get coaches that are not there necessarily for themselves, but just for the passion of the sport, spreading the word and trying to make people better.
Yeah, and I hate to say it because it shouldn't be the case, but, you know, sport is often the thing that breaks down barriers between people, and it can break down barriers between nations and ideologies. And this is the way it's got to be if the world's going to be a better place, and sport should just charge ahead and do it and never concern itself with political issues.
No, I mean, it is. I find that's very sad, and we've seen that a lot of recent times, you know, where certain nations are being excluded because of the political strife between two countries, and it's very, very sad. I'm with you. I think that the sport actually can be used to mend those fences.
But at the same time, I mean, the argument is you do get sport being used by people, such as the case of the Nazis and the Olympic Games. At the same time, you've got to protect yourself against those sorts of uses. But
without a shadow of a
doubt. Yeah, generally, the ideal should be just play sport, mate. Don't worry about the other rubbish.
Well, you talk about the other rubbish, and I think just quickly I want to touch on the fact that, I mean, we watched the Olympic Games, and the boxing again really brought the sport into disrepute with some of the decisions that were made. And I was very pleased to read that all 36 referees and judges used in Rio have been removed by IBA for the time being because of their officiating overshadowed what went on in the ring. And now there's an investigation as to what went on. And I know there were accusations that a lot of the confederations that had made large donations to IBA and to help it with funding were the nations that got decisions in dubious fights. And look, I think we all know that's probably what has happened. It's incredibly sad that those fighters who've trained so hard for Olympic glory were stripped of that. But at least the officials have all been suspended for now, and hopefully those who were guilty, we never see them grace a ring ever again.
You bring up an interesting point, because boxing is done on that a judge's decision basis. You know, it's some one person or the panel's interpretation of the events they see. It's not like 100 metres where, you know, the first bloke over the line is the winner, and there can't be too much argument with that. There's other sports as well, gymnastics, diving, those sorts of sports. Now, occasionally you hear ripples coming out of from those sports about umpiring and judgments, etc. But those are very nice and polite sports, if you know what I mean. Boxing's not necessarily a polite sport, so it's no surprise that they're the ones we hear about the most, that they're, you know, the infighting, so to speak. And the accusations.
I mean, I understand. I think gymnastics changed their scoring this time around. I don't remember exactly how it worked. But again, they were trying to make it fair, because if you remember, there would be a panel of judges from the various countries and they would give their votes. And sometimes those that were in the neighbouring countries were a little bit more in favour of that particular athlete. So now I believe what they've done is they've kind of changed it slightly just to make it a little bit fairer. And I don't think we heard, as you said there, any complaints about the scoring in those events that you mentioned.
No. I mean, traditionally there have been, let's call them rivalries, where, you know, judges from one country were not likely to give athletes from another country as high a mark as perhaps they deserved.
Absolutely.
Those rumours seem to have disappeared, that's for sure.
They do indeed. Now, I just want to say, because we've always been critical of the Perth Glory and the way they've run things, I actually just want to give them a pat on the back, because I do feel that coming into this season, they are actually on the right track. I mean, Kenny Lowe's done well. He's recruited a lot of local boys have come back, players that were from Western Australia and have then gone overseas. And hopefully they've still got the hunger and the pride to represent WA. But also, you know, in this opening game, they are actually looking to celebrate the first team in 96 playing their opening game against Sydney Olympic. And all of the players that took part in that game are going to be presented with commemorative shirts. And, you know, they've tried to do that. They had the ridiculous 15-year anniversary, which was seen through by most fans, that all it really was a marketing opportunity for the club to try and ride on the coattails of the club in its NSL days. And then we also saw them try to do something with the Perth Kangaroos, where they invited all of those players. And, of course, the Perth Kangaroos were the forerunner for the Perth Glory. And then when the players actually got to the ground, no one knew where they were meant to go. Then they were given a box where they had to buy their own drinks. So the club has kind of screwed up those events in the past. But it looks to me as if this time around, they've actually got it right and they're doing it properly. And so having criticised them in the past, it's only fair, I think, that we acknowledge them and say, well done from learning by your mistakes. And hopefully that this is a sign that the club is on the right track now and moving in the right direction.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the A-League gets underway this weekend, actually.
It does, yep.
Depending on when you happen to be listening to this podcast. And the Glory haven't been out and about town waving their flags like they have been in previous years, but they haven't been absent either. They've maintained a profile without it being that, oh, we're going to take them on style start to the season.
No, and again, I think that's really sensible on their part. You know, it's been going about things fairly low-key. I'm sure they would rather have a higher profile. Some of that is the media isn't giving them the profile that they used to enjoy. But I think it's also Kenny Lowe's style. Kenny Lowe's not a loudmouth kind of guy. He can be, you know, he can come out with a great soundbite for the media if he wants. But he is a sort of understated, go about his business quietly. And I think maybe that's beginning to permeate through the club as well.
One thing I do like about Kenny Lowe is when he gets a dumb question, he throws it back. And it's almost like you can hear the interviewers or the person asking the question go, oh yeah, I better think through that a bit more.
Well, I think, and I mean, you know, I've been around the sporting landscape now for a while in Perth, and you can talk to athletes from other sports, and they are frustrated that a lot of the journalists in WA that turn up at press conferences, they don't do their homework and they don't know anything, and they just ask standard generic questions hoping to get, you know, a soundbite that will make their news editor happy.
Yeah, and hopefully Kenny maintains that, because I really enjoy his press conferences just for that point.
I don't know if you saw the Ryder Cup player who was asked how his first experience in the Ryder Cup was. And he gave a four-letter word as his original answer. and when he said, and if you'd like me to elaborate, it was really, and then the four-letter word. Now that's a good press conference.
Speaking of profile in the media, when does the AHL start, the Australian Hockey League?
It's actually on at the moment, John.
Oh, where's it being played?
In Perth.
Oh, well, actually, to be honest, I did know that. I was just being a little bit smart.
I knew that.
You wouldn't have known. Most people don't know. In fact, if you live in Perth, you wouldn't know, because it's just invisible at the moment. It's been invisible the whole time, even in the hockey community. It's been invisible. And I'm just wondering why they missed such a great opportunity on the back of people having seen hockey at the Olympics, not to promote it more, especially when I can turn on and listen on the internet and listen to Melbourne radio. And since the Olympic Games, consistently running advertisements for the Festival of Hockey that's coming up in Melbourne, with featuring Australia and Malaysia and a couple of other countries. Now, that's been 5 or 6 weeks now that's been getting flogged on commercial radio. But in Perth, we hear nothing about our own Australian Hockey League.
Well, can I tell you that even, John, it's had coverage up here in India, because the Indian under-21 team is playing in the men's competition, and they'd gone through their first four games unbeaten, and so they actually got coverage in the newspapers up here. Now, hockey, believe it or not, doesn't get – you get pages of cricket. You've now got the Indian Super League football going on and the Kabaddi World Cup, but they still managed to find column centimetre space to give the Indian under-21 hockey team coverage playing in the AHL up here in India.
Well, there's been no coverage on commercial television or radio at all. There's been no results. There's been nothing. And it's really disappointing. And I don't know who, if that's the media just ignoring it and Hockey WA or Hockey Australia have been trying to push it as much as they can, or whether it's because it's not coming out from the Hockey WA, Hockey Australia end. I don't know, but it is really, really disappointing.
No, that is. I mean, you know, we both love that sport and we also think how outstanding it is. And I was actually talking to a guy up here who was saying, and this is what really worries me about certain places or the way of the world today. He goes, oh, the sport in India is dead now because they didn't win a medal at the Olympics. And I said, what do you mean they didn't win? I said, they were never going to win a medal at the Olympics. India was not good enough. You know, it takes time. And if you look at your junior team, who are doing really well and have the potential to win the Junior World Cup. And if you look at Argentina, they won the Junior World Cup 2005 in Hobart. They won the gold medal. So it is a 10-year cycle, and you have to invest in those young players, follow those young players. And I said, in 2024, you've got the chance of probably winning gold. But at the moment, if you genuinely thought you were going to win a medal in Rio, then, you know, you're just having a laugh.
Yeah. Now, the other side of what I'm saying when we talk about, you know, what's the administrators doing, et cetera, et cetera, this is something I often say about football in this country as well. Don't worry about other sports and what other codes are doing and rah, rah, what other coverage people are getting. Have a look in your own backyard. Now, I guarantee you there's more people play senior hockey in WA than play senior, than play football. Guarantee it. But where are those people? If football can fill, you know, a stadium with 40,000 people on a weekly basis, why can't hockey do it? What is hockey not doing about it? What are the people who play hockey, why aren't they supporting it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the game needs to really look, and I've been saying this to people at the FIH, needs to look at how it markets itself, because to me it's far more exciting, far more skillful, and I'll upset some people there, than football, than soccer. It doesn't have people faking and rolling around on the ground. It's honest. The players are supremely fit. And I just think that they need to start highlighting the difference to get people into it, you know?
Yeah, it's about if they just mobilize the player base, not even going outside of that, but the people who actually just mobilize the player base, they'd have an, you know, 500% improvement in numbers, in figures, and all those sort of diametrics that they judge these things by.
Well, John, I think we're running out of time, but I know there's a couple of other things you want to bring up just before we close.
Well, sadly, in the last few weeks in Australia, the world of sports journalism has lost two big names. Norman May, the great ABC commentator, perhaps best known for his call at the 1980 Olympics as a Mean Machines win in the relay in swimming, and Rebecca Wilson have both passed away. Rebecca just recently, the last night, in fact, just 54 years old, which is terribly sad. And they'll both be sorely missed by the wider Australian community through their endeavours in the sports broadcasting field.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, I must admit I wasn't a fan of a lot of the things Rebecca Wilson wrote, but the one thing you have to say is she provoked conversation. And if you get people talking about issues in sports, sometimes that can be a really good thing because it opens people's eyes to other opportunities or other opinions. And, you know, as I say, I didn't agree with a lot of hers, but at least she made people talk about it and discuss things from a different point of view.
Oh, exactly. And I don't know that she was the first female sports journalist by any stretch, but she certainly seemed to be the first that was prepared to stick her head above the walls and let people take a shot at her for her opinions. Like you, I didn't agree with everything she said, but she was prepared to stand up and say it. In a lot of ways, she was, you know, a trailblazer for women in sports journalism and say, it's all right. You can, don't worry about what the boys throw at you. Just stand up there and have your say.
But I think that stands to anyone who's listening. If you've got an opinion, if you've got the courage to stand up and say it, then stick to it. You know, that why should you change your opinion unless you find out that someone points out that you were wrong?
Well, what was it Maynard Keynes said? I changed my mind because the facts changed. So,
yep.
When facts change.
Exactly. You have no other option.
That's it. And especially when you're talking opinions, you know, opinion, everybody's got one. We know what the rest of that line is. you know, opinions can change because facts change, and that's the way the world works. While we're still here, congratulations to Cronulla for their win in the Rugby League Grand Final. 50 years in the making. Interesting Grand Final. You had the very divisive Paul Gallen collecting the Winners' Cup, and the very all-embracing Cameron Smith making one of the great post-Grand Final speeches of all time.
Well, I missed all of that because I was up here, but I must admit I was over the moon that the Sharks won, because it's always great to see a team whose fans have been loyal for those periods of time finally getting what they deserve. And I must admit, I mentioned earlier my co-commentator up here, or co-presenter, Stephen McIver from New Zealand. He actually presents the rugby league over there, so he was keeping tabs on the game the whole time and had a real interest as to what was happening. So I was across it, but obviously missed those post-match speeches.
One of the great things was, as the final whistle blew, Michael Ennis, who was playing his final game, he had already announced his retirement, nicknamed Ennis the Menace, and perhaps hated by opposition fans as much as he's loved by the fans of the club he's playing for at the time, he ran straight off the field, and there was a group of Cronulla ball boys standing next to the touch judge, two or three of them. He ran straight over to these kids and gave them all a great big hug. It was the first thing he did when the siren sounded, and I thought it was just fantastic to see that.
Well, that's something they'll never forget.
Oh, no, you're right. And the look on his face, he just beelined straight for these kids. There you go, boys, get into it. This is for us. It was fantastic. And if you get the chance, check out Cameron Smith post-match on YouTube. It is worth looking at. How a guy can play the game he did and then say what he did is just amazing.
I will try and look that up, but I think that probably brings us to the end of this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it.
See you, Ash.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is
foul. See ya. We'll be back next week.